All right. Welcome. 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 Today is Friday, March 18th. We actually have a special guest today. I'm going to have him introduce himself, and then we're going to have some questions because we've had some listeners reach out about mortgage questions. So, Michael, if you want to take it.
Sure. Thank you. Hello, everybody. My name is Michael Ruggieri with Fifth Third Bank. I am a mortgage loan officer. I've been in the industry for 20 plus years, done just about everything there is to do in the business. And I've been in originating for just about a little shy of a decade now. Love what I do. Love helping people out and just excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for coming. So, Michael, I just had a couple quick questions. Personally, so you said you've been doing this about 20 years plus. How did you get into it?
By accident. I was actually out of college, and I was set to go to law school, and I decided I really didn't want to go to school anymore. Okay. I'd had took a little break, bartended for a couple of years, and a bank had called me for a mortgage job. Okay. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't even know anything about the mortgage business. And started the business off in the late 90s, basically sitting down at a desk with a rotary phone, a stack of applications, yeah, a pen and whiteout and a calculator, and basically took inbound calls and took applications over the phone.
Okay.
So basically I was an originator.
So, okay. Okay. So you're basically vetting people.
Basically. All right. And this was back in 1997.
Gotcha. Very nice. Now, when did you start seeing everything kind of change with the tech business? Because you said you had a rotary phone, you were sitting there. Was it the early 2000s when it started getting more of the computer generated and you started doing?
You know, it depends on where I was at. I mean, the bigger banks I worked for definitely had more of the technology. The smaller companies, which is what this bank was when I first started, was definitely more of an old school, privately owned bank.
Gotcha.
The gentleman was very old school, and loan officers, I don't think even had computers in that company, so probably the mid-2000s.
And was this all in Florida as well?
Or was no, this was actually in Rhode Island, where I'm from originally. I've been in Florida since 1999, but originally I was in Rhode Island.
Gotcha.
So that's how I broke in the business up north.
Interesting. And what brought you to Florida?
The same thing brings everybody to Florida.
Opportunity?
Opportunity. Had an opportunity to move down here with a friend who had some family down here.
And, okay.
Was just ready for a change. I liked Florida. I liked the weather. I always wanted to live here, and I took a chance. Came here in my mid-20s and never looked back, really.
There you go. 20-plus years now.
Yep.
Yeah. Very nice. So a few of the questions that we received are mostly, you know, general questions that some of the actual listeners don't know how to start a loan or get a loan or what kind of documentation they need for a loan. So we're going to kind of ask and start from the beginning. Which is what kind of documentation does somebody need to show to you to even get a pre-qual?
Well, I like to see their income information, their 2 years W-2, so 2021 and 2020 W-2s.
Okay.
30 days of pay stubs, which could be 2 pay stubs or 4, depending on how you get paid, and bank statements to show source of funds. But primarily, you know, when you buy a home, even with 3% down, you still need to show your money.
Okay.
So I like to see 2 months bank statements to see where the money's coming from. If they're borrowing it from a 401k, which is very common with first-time home buyers,
yeah.
I like to see the retirement statement, so usually the full retirement statement, which is usually quarterly.
Yeah.
And I'd like to look at that income. If they are self-employed, I always ask for tax returns.
Yeah.
2 years corporate and personal.
Yeah.
So that's very important.
Now, if they're not self-employed and, you know, and they work for somebody, what's a good amount of time to show that they've been at that employer?
Well, we verify 2 years.
Okay.
So on the application, the 1003, it's a 2-year history. And if it's less than 2 years, we just basically get a previous job.
Gotcha.
So as long as they have current income and they've been at the job for a certain amount of time in the same industry, it's usually not an issue.
Gotcha. Okay. Perfect. So very simple. We're talking W-2s. Everybody has them. You know, you're going to be filing your taxes. So a couple tax returns. You're talking bank statements, which is something that you could pull from any app, you know, through your banking statements. And then we're talking just proof of employment.
Correct.
Right? Okay. Correct. Well, that's not bad at all. So what is a normal time frame in getting a pre-qual?
I can actually get a pre-qual pretty quick. If I get an application, we have an application system at Fifth Third, which is fantastic. The customer actually goes online and does an online application. Takes them about 15 minutes. That's how simple it is.
Okay.
Once I receive the application, I run credit. I run through my system. If everything looks clean, I can have a pre-approval within 15, 20 minutes.
Okay.
So it's a pretty quick process.
So we always get these random questions too. Some of the viewers get letters in the mail and they have a pre-qual. You've been already pre-qualed and they ask, are these fake or how do they get these numbers? And I always say, you got to talk to a mortgage lender. You have to talk to somebody who actually is going to get your information. These people are just fishing.
Exactly. It's solicitation. That's all it is. It's an advertisement. And nothing wrong with that. That's what that's how we all try to make money. So it's all about, advertising.
Yeah.
But it can be misleading. And I've had to, explain to customers who get these letters in the mail saying, hey, I'm already pre-qualified with so-and-so bank. I never applied. I'm like, well, what did the letter tell you? And then, of course, it's just basically more or less you can be pre-approved if you give us a call and talk to us.
Okay.
So it's, more or less it's advertising.
Yeah. It's a call to action.
Pretty much.
So taking all those things into consideration, do you want to explain a little bit about debt to income and how it can affect you?
Absolutely. That's actually one of the most biggest concerns in qualifying a mortgage is debt to income ratio, especially in this day and age when home prices are at an all-time high.
Yep.
It's very important to make sure your debt to income ratio is where it needs to be. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, which is conventional financing, they can be flexible. They can go up to 49% DTI. The perfect DTI is probably 45.
Okay.
Less is better, obviously, but anytime you go over 45, it starts to get
in DTI, he's meaning his debt to income.
Right.
So what he means by that is 45%. You don't want to be paying 45% in debt. If you go over that threshold and have to pay more than the 45% of your actual monthly income, then it affects your loan.
Correct.
Okay. So, back in the day, I think the first time I got a loan for when I bought my first house, I think the debt to income in Nevada was, 29%. It was really low for some reason because I was a first-time home buyer, and I don't know why, but I had 29 is kind of like the number that sticks out of my head where they had a cap. And I don't know if it changes. Does that change constantly with the debt to income?
No, I know. What year was that?
2009.
That's probably why. 2009 was a different animal. That was right after the crash. Banks got very conservative with their lending.
Yeah,
so that would explain it.
Yeah, it was a little bit more of a beast back then.
It was a different market. It was more of an FHA market.
Yeah,
it's predominantly what we were seeing back then.
Yeah,
and it was just a different time. And fortunately, we were able to recover from that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
which is fortunate for all of us.
I would have to say Florida and Nevada were probably one of the two. Or actually probably the most affected by
absolutely. They were the two biggest hit and took the longest to recover as well.
Yeah.
I don't think we recovered fully in Florida until probably 2014.
Yeah.
It took that long.
I would probably agree. Nevada was right around 2014, 2015. That actually leveled out to where they were back in 99 to 98. Because a lot of places were being, built in the late 90s. And then they had that huge spike in 06. And multiple people bought houses for $150,000. They were selling them for $600,000 in 06, 07. And then it probably took about 2015 until they got back to that $150,000 where they were back to where they were from the original 99 when they were built. So it was kind of crazy. And I know that when we did some research in Florida, basically the same thing happened here. It was just a giant bubble that popped.
Exactly. It happened so fast too. I remember I was working for a builder at the time, and there was a site called mortgageimplode.com. And I was doing wholesale. I was a broker, so I was using wholesale lenders.
Yeah.
And every day you had to check that site to make sure a lender that you were doing a loan with wasn't going to go out of business.
Really?
Because if that happened and you had a loan closing in a week, you had to find another lender to close it in that timely manner.
How stressful was that?
Extremely. Extremely. It was absolutely insane. I've never seen anything like it, and I hope never to again.
Yeah. Oh, wow, that's crazy. So going now, we're seeing rates change.
Correct.
Constantly. So what's your opinion on this? Is it them gearing up for something or?
It's a necessary evil. We enjoyed low rates for a long time. However, with inflation being at an all-time high, it's just a requirement. Basically, rates go up and then they're predicting that the purchase market is going to cool down.
Uh-huh.
It's not going to burst. It's going to cool off, basically, where its prices are going to stabilize.
Do you see a 3-5% cool off, a 10% cool off? Is there any sort of monetary cool off?
It's very hard to predict. And if I could predict that, I would
have a crystal ball.
I would probably live beyond a beach somewhere right now.
Yeah, right.
It's hard to say. It really is. I mean, I know I've talked to other realtors in the industry, and they are pretty confident that the banks are going to release their foreclosure listings this year, which is great news.
Yes.
Fantastic news for first-time home buyers, because right now they're hurting the most from this, because it's very hard to find a house because inventory is at an all-time low.
I have, you know, friends of mine who have been looking for months now, and they get outbid, and they get outbid, and it's not even they're going above and beyond what the ask price is, but people are just coming up with crazy numbers. And some of it is straight cash, and they just cannot compete.
Well, you're having a lot of people moving from the Northeast. Basically, they're just downsizing. They're coming to Florida. They have their home in Long Island they've had for 40 years.
Yep.
It's worth a fortune, and they can sell it and buy something cash here. Even though it's an inflated market here, it's still cheaper than the Northeast.
Oh, yeah, still.
By a long shot.
Uh-huh.
So you're seeing a lot of that. You've seen, you know, so that is a challenge. But once again, with these foreclosures coming up, knock on wood, then I really do predict that's going to help things a lot.
Do you think that they're holding them potentially for busy season, which is...
Hard to say. It's hard to say. The banks are tricky with their foreclosures. They don't like to tell too much.
Yeah.
I've noticed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's really one of those, they're going to keep it secret as long as they can.
They play their cards very close.
Yes, they do. They certainly do.
So, busy season normally begins... probably around late April, beginning of May. Correct. For you guys as well, right? And it goes strong till August, just like us. I mean, we have a large influx of people moving here because of school being let out in the rest of parts of the country. And then a lot of people like to get their moves done during summer because it's just less stressful on them because of the holiday issues and everything like that. Would you say that you do more loans during those few months than you do the remaining of the year, or has it been steady with the loans?
Absolutely. Florida is usually a pretty steady place because it's always summer. But the summer months here definitely are busier.
Yeah.
And the first quarter is always a little on the slower side. January, February, a little slower.
Yeah.
And then March and April, it starts picking up with applications. But funny, this year is a little different because with rates going up, the refinance business has halted. It's still out there. I still have a few refinance transactions I'm working with, but it's nowhere near what it was a year ago, 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Not even close. But purchases have been a little bit slower. A lot of pre-approvals.
Yeah.
However, same problem. People can't find a house.
Yeah.
So I'm running into that challenge. So it's a little different than last year.
Yeah.
But once again, I'm confident we're going to see it. We're going to see a turn.
So if we're looking at first-time home buyers, so somebody who's, you know, trying to purchase their first home, do you have any options or any recommendations on certain loan types? Is there FHA maybe works a little bit better for them because it's easier to get into, or conventional if they're saving up more money? Is there something easier for them to understand how to, you know, I always say if you can't, it's unfortunate, but when I do put on the application or the offer, they obviously ask for your loan type. And conventional is obviously stronger than FHA because there's a little less hoops you have to go through. You're putting more money down, so it just seems like a stronger loan. But FHA, of course, is not a terrible loan because it gets a lot of people where they need to be because they might not have the capital to get into their dream home, but they can put a little bit less down and still get it. Is there anything that you could recommend for like a first-time home buyer that they should either do more research on one type or the other, or are both perfect?
Definitely do your research on both loans. The most important thing to do with first-time home buyers is talk to a professional, ask a lot of questions.
Okay.
It's a very big process. It's basically a life.
Mm-hmm.
A mortgage, I know the terminology of mortgage is actually life debt.
Yeah.
That's where the term comes from.
Yeah.
A little mortgage, trivia there. But so it's a big, big decision to make, and it's not something you should do hastily. It's just something you should definitely do, put a lot of time into. And I recommend you ask the right questions. You talk to a professional, somebody you trust.
Yep.
So you have to trust who you work with. That's like any business. you have to trust, you know, anybody who you do business with. So make sure you have someone who's reliable, who's helpful, who will answer your questions, will guide you in the right direction, and just basically assist you the way you need to be treated. Treat people the way I want to be treated. That's always my terminology.
There you go.
I remember my first house, when I bought my first house in the 90s, the loan officer, who was a friend of mine, did not do that for me.
You know?
And it was not a very fun process. And I think that's just a bad way to do business.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, with first-time home buyers, in terms of the loan amount, I recommend conventional, and this is why a lot of sellers are steering away from government loans right now. VA and FHAs are somewhat of a dirty word in the market.
Yeah.
Because there is a lot more red tape because there are government-backed loans. So lots of sellers aren't even accepting.
Yeah, when
FHA pre-approvals right now.
When we look into our, you know, multiple listing system, we see the loans and a lot of people are just saying conventional cash.
Right.
Those are the two they're taking. They're not even talking about VA or FHA right now.
The good news is conventional has modified its guidelines to the point where it's a lot easier to get financing. That's the great news. 3% down for first time home buyers.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic.
So back in the day, conventional was the traditional 20%. That's what everyone kind of looked at conventional. Many years ago.
Before my time, actually.
You know, and then it started going down to the 15 and the 10, you know, but through different kind of, especially banks or through different kind of loan, you know, originators, you can get it at a lower rate. And I think that's what people are starting to understand with conventional, is they're actually able to get conventional without having to put that 20% down, right?
Exactly. So that's hard to do. It's, once again, unless you're, you know, you saved your money very well, or you were given money.
Correct.
It's very hard for a first-time home buyer to come up with 20%. It's nearly impossible, to be honest.
Yeah, especially with the home prices right now.
People in their late 20s, early 30s, they make an average income of $50,000 to $60,000 a year. That was a good income at one time, mm-hmm. but in this, you know, inflated market in Central Florida, it's becoming more of a lower median, which is unfortunate. I mean, I remember when I first moved here. I think my first job, I made about $40,000 a year, and I was doing very well. Uh-huh. And it's just amazing how, you know,
things have
changed. The good news is jobs pay a lot better here now than they did 20 years ago. That's the great news. So a lot of first-time home buyers do make a good income.
Yeah.
At least I have several that I'm working with now, and they're all, you know,
now,
high income.
Now, switching to first-time home buyers, if they have student debt. We get a lot of questions about student debt and how it affects debt to income ratio and actually purchasing a home. And we try to explain to them, ask somebody who has more information than us, because it changes, you know, sometimes it's a percent or a little bit over a percent, but do you want to explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. And that's a great question, because I do see a lot of student loan debt with a lot of the younger buyers. And the good news is, Freddie Mac, which is conventional, mm-hmm. only charges half a percent for student loan monthly amounts, and 1% for Fannie Mae. So I always go Freddie. I always do the Freddie Mac route when I have a student loan.
Okay.
So I have student loan debt, but it's case by case. I mean, student loans that are under $10,000, it's not usually going to affect their debt ratios. But when you get a little bit higher, like in the 50,000 to 60,000 range, which I have seen, it gets to point even 0.5 can really mess up the debt ratio.
Yeah.
So what I recommend when that happens is the customer go to the student loan provider and get a requested payoff. So a lot of times these loans are deferred. They're not even paying them yet, but we still have to count it. It's just because they're not paying doesn't mean it's not affecting the debt ratio.
Yeah.
So what I recommend is what they go to the student loan provider and get a proposed payment plan and get a breakdown.
Okay.
And usually that helps. That helps the debt ratio.
Gotcha.
I do that with Fifth Third has a really good doctor program.
Okay.
Yeah, I do deal with doctors, and a lot of doctors have student loans.
Of course.
Especially younger doctors. Uh-huh. So that's a great way to help with the debt ratio.
We know some friends who went to school and just finished, and they're $600,000 in debt after becoming doctors. So it's not unheard of.
One more reason I didn't go to law school.
Right, exactly. we have some friends who went to law school, too, and they're in their mid to late 40s, and they're still paying it off.
Yeah, even an MBA, which I was looking to do about 7-8 years ago, same thing. It was just so expensive.
Oh yeah. So switching to credit scores, what's a good credit score for you guys? Like, what's something that you guys like to see?
The higher, the better. 740 is ideal.
Okay.
Anything over that's bragging rights.
Okay.
That's good to have. I mean, you should always monitor your credit. I always recommend, I will say this, though, for anybody out there, stay away from Credit Karma.
Okay.
It's a joke.
Okay.
It's an inflated score. It doesn't mean anything. It's not even worth even trying. So stay away from that
one. So Credit Karma,
stay away.
I've always heard bad things about that. It's basically
go through the three bureaus, Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian.
And you can ask if you don't know yourself, you can ask your bank. Absolutely. Easily pull your credit.
Absolutely. It'll be a soft pull. I know, where I bank, I get something called Credit Journey, and it checks my score, and it basically it lets me know my score goes up. So I check my score probably a couple times a month to make sure. I mean, you know, credit is very important. And the biggest thing I've noticed with people with their credit is they have collections they don't even know they have, especially medical bills.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody goes, you know, you go to the ER, something happens, you have insurance, but a lot of times it doesn't cover everything. And a lot of times these hospitals or medical centers they just basically put into collection, don't even tell you. And I've had people with 680 credit scores or really lower scores, and they don't know why. And they have a $300 medical collection, $300.
Yeah.
Something so simple, but they don't know what's there, but it's damaging their score.
When my wife was pregnant with our son, we went to Palm Springs for a weekend just to get away, and she ended up having food poisoning at the hotel.
Oh, no.
And so we went to Eisenhower Hospital, which is in Palm Springs, and of course they didn't take our insurance because we were living in Nevada at the time, so I'm just worried, and she was about 5 months pregnant at the time, so do whatever you have to do. So they checked her in, and they took her vitals, and they basically gave her some stuff to make sure she stopped vomiting because of the food poisoning. No big deal. We ended up going back to the hotel, and then the next couple of days we head home. I get a bill from Eisenhower about 9 months later for about $3,000 just because she was seen by a doctor. I had no idea that that was sitting on my credit, so I immediately called Eisenhower and had him renegotiate and said, this is a little ridiculous. It was about, you know, an hour and a half, and you gave her anti-nausea medicine. And they dropped the bill from about $3,000, I think $900. And I just ended up just saying, okay, and I paid it off completely. And, of course, it got pulled off my credit. But I had no idea because it took so long to get there. Yeah. So I always recommend, you know, if you're looking at stepping into a mortgage, get all your ducks in a row. Make sure you do a little research beforehand because these things can creep up on you. You could totally forget. I totally forgot that we actually went to this, you know. It's not a fantastic memory to have when your wife's pregnant and vomiting. So kind of just completely escaped me, but 9 months later, creep back up on me.
Right, right. And that's the important thing with credit. It's just so important to pay attention.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely not, definitely don't take a blind eye to your credit.
Because now, if
it could really make a break.
Would you recommend if you're interested in buying a home and you have a couple credit cards that have balances, do you recommend paying those credit cards off beforehand, or do you recommend having a balance on them? What's a good thing for people to have?
Case by case. Okay. If it's affecting their debt ratios, absolutely pay them off. I recommend anybody pay their cards off every month. I know that's not realistic for everybody, mm-hmm. but it's recommended.
Yeah.
Because nowadays, years ago, if you paid late, your credit score would go down.
Uh-huh.
But now if you exceed your limitation, like where you get come close to exceeding your limit, your score will drop like a bad habit. I've seen
dramatically
hundreds of points in some cases for somebody who basically comes close to maxing out a card. So it's very important to keep those credit card balances as low as you can. Use them in emergency use only. Use them responsibly. That's all I can say about that.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the unfortunate reality right now is a lot of people use those not necessarily as emergency, but they use it as a day-to-day ritual.
Well, I've been in Florida for 20 years. I learned people like to have fun here.
Yeah.
Understandably, it's a wonderful place to live, but people like to exceed their
limits.
Beyond their means. Exactly, their limits. People like to live above their means.
Uh-huh.
And I've seen it countless times. And
well, things add up out here. Yeah. You know, you go to a couple places before you know it, you just dropped a couple $100, yeah. You know,
especially the old expression of my family used to say, robbing Peter to pay Paul, basically. Uh-huh. And it'll creep up on you. Just be careful. Yeah,
so
be responsible.
Let's end on this. What is something that someone wants, or if somebody's interested in getting into doing loans, how does somebody look into that? Do they apply at a bank? Do they apply at a mortgage company? If somebody's interested in actually becoming a loan originator or actually...
Oh, for a career.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know, it's tougher now because a lot of banks want to have experienced loan officers with a book of business.
Yeah.
And they actually go in. There's a way, my boss actually showed me this. There's a way to go in and actually check people's yearly production.
Oh.
So a lot of banks are actually checking.
Real estate does that as well.
People actually do.
Mm-hmm.
So to make sure that the loan officers are strong. Anybody breaking into the business, you know what? The best way to start, and this is how I started, work in a direct channel, a call center.
Okay.
A couple of credit unions local basically have call centers. And that's a great way to learn. It's, you know, it's school of hard knocks in a way because you're getting multiple phone calls a day and you're getting every question thrown at you imaginable.
Yeah.
And you're on the fly, but it's a great way to learn. And usually it's a salary plus bonus. So
yeah.
It's more stable than being a straight commission position and just basically pay your dues.
Kind of like sink or swim, right?
Not really. That's you know, I'd like to have a little more of a positive tone on that. This isn't Glengarry Glen Ross. Always be closing. So it's I like to have a little more of a gentler touch to it. But this is a good industry to be in. It's I would recommend start with a direct channel. Start with, you know, that more of a direct. This way, it's you learn the business that way, and then once you get some experience after a year or two, then maybe you can possibly look into more of a retail position, and you know, go out there and meet some realtors and make the connections you need to make.
Start
your business. Basically, because you're an entrepreneur, you're basically a business owner.
Yeah.
And so it's basically like any business, you have to start from the ground up.
Yeah, that's what we emphasize here in real estate as well. I mean, you're starting from scratch.
Basically.
You have to get out there as much as possible, being a real estate agent, and get your name out there any means necessary. I mean, without going into unfortunate debt, which is a lot of real estate agents, they start out going down, you know, the whole advertisement avenue, and they don't have any income to show, and it inevitably ends up bad.
What I recommend with real estate, actually, start working for a builder.
Yeah.
Work for a Lennar or a Taylor Morrison. They pay a salary. You have to work your weekends. You have to work pretty much quite a bit. But once again, it's paying your dues if you want to learn the industry.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, another option too is also rental property management.
Yep.
Rentals. I mean, that's a good way to start as well.
You need to be. Some of them don't require necessarily actually getting a real estate license if you're working under a property manager.
Oh, really? I thought you had to be licensed to be.
Not necessarily. If you're working under somebody, not necessarily. You can basically be an assistant and still learn on the job, and you don't necessarily have to have your license. But
another builder, option too, sure. And my barber actually is a licensed realtor, and she's been on the fence for quite a few years now.
Oh yeah,
she hasn't jumped yet. So, but anyway, I recommend. Hold on to your job.
Uh-huh.
When you're in real estate. You can do it on the weekends. You can do it, you know, in your spare time. But hold on to your full-time salary. Hold on to that paycheck first. And then once you make it, then you can obviously make that plunge.
Oh, yeah. I worked a night job when I got my license when I was 25. And I worked as a server in a restaurant until I was able to actually get, you know, because it does take years, unfortunately. It's not an immediate success. Unless you have somebody who takes you in under your wing and has a book of business that they're willing to give you, because real estate, like you said, you work for yourself. It's not an easy, you know, no one's really out there to make sure that you're doing, you have to make it yourself.
Yeah. It's a tough industry. It's a lot of people think it's so easy. You just go show a property and
that's well, and it. You know, mortgage it's and,
not
and
at all.
Mortgage and real estate agents, they go hand in hand. You know,
absolutely.
You know, one needs the other, just like, you know, we add insurance in there as well, because we all have to harmoniously work together to make this job done. It's a lot of people don't understand the nuances behind it. They put an offer in and they go, okay, are we going to get it or not? And it's like, you have no idea how many people are actually working behind the scenes to make sure that you get the keys at the end of this thing. So it's always good to be able to talk to somebody who's also in the industry, but not necessarily in real estate, but they work with us.
We're all in this together.
Right? Uh-huh. We're all trying to make it. But we want to thank everybody. We want to thank Michael again for stopping by, having a little chit chat with us. We'd love to have you back. So we'll have to carve out some more time in the near future.
Happy to be back. This was great. I had a great time.
Yeah, you did well. You did really well, actually. His first podcast and his first time sitting on a mic.
The old theater background. the bug came back.
Right.
The bug came back. So,
you know, this weekend, again, we're going to have thousands upon thousands of open houses flowing through the site from all the way Jacksonville down to Miami. So if you guys have any questions, please reach out to the comment section. You can actually reach us on our Instagram or Twitter. You can reach us through Podbean or actually the website itself, homeuplink.com. So again, thank you again.